As we tick towards the end of a politically tumultuous year, which magazines and newspapers stood out from the rest? From running titles and news magazines to city pages and book fairs, we're looking back at the year in print today on The Stack. On today's show, a selection of the very best features from the past 12 months here on The Stack, including one magazine that knows its city better than most.
We try to search for topics that are relevant, not only for people who are here, but also for people who are maybe living in London or maybe living in some other city.
Plus, in an age where some have forgotten what the printed page is actually for, is there any room for photojournalism?
These sudden, unexpected, horrifying moments that come from nowhere. Press don't know it's going to happen, and so it becomes the realm of the public to photograph and document it on their phones.
All that and more coming up on The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Stack. I'm Ben Rylan. This week's program is the first of our special end-of-year presentations, looking back at some of our standout features from throughout 2016. As we exit the year, it might seem rather difficult to recall the many violent events that dominated headlines. Some months ago, much of the focus was on Belgium, after a series of deadly bombings. Zed Nelson is one of the most respected professionals in the world of photojournalism, having attracted acclaim for his work in some of the most dangerous and troubled parts of the globe. His passion for the art of photography has led to his work being exhibited at Tate Britain, the National Portrait Gallery, and as part of the permanent collection at the Victoria and Albert Museum. He joined Monocle's Tom Edwards to look at the role of the photojournalist today.
You know, what we're seeing is the sort of rise of citizen journalism as well. So these kind of events, these sudden, unexpected, horrifying moments that come from nowhere, press don't know it's going to happen. And so it becomes the realm of the public to photograph and document it on their phones, which is what I've seen happen a lot. And then you end up with these kind of images, which in some ways they're just as revealing and honest and true of the situation. You don't really need a professional there to craft great compositions or anything, but they're scrappy, and somehow they're more shocking for their scrappiness. And you know, these images of people sort of literally just lying on the ground, still smoke in the air, other people around them running or walking or even ignoring them at times, probably in their own shock. They are shocking, and you know, the context of the images, the location, deep down is what shocks us, I think, because it's an airport and it's what we associate with doing ourselves.
And I guess the viewer of those images can so easily place themselves into the heart of that action. It's interesting that what you said about they're no less true, they're no less, like, we're talking about a kind of a notions of authenticity, I guess, which is complicated, but does it worry you in any way as a photojournalist that citizen journalists kind of have their day? Is it a problem? Do you think there's maybe some internal editing that goes on by you and your colleagues that maybe your lay member of the public, you know, they're not trained to make those judgments? Does that matter? Is there anything that concerns you about that shift?
No, not really, actually. Partly because I'm not really a news photographer. I'm not even sure I'm a photojournalist. I'm a documentary photographer, and I look at issues and stories, but I tend to do them much more long-term and in-depth. So what's happening, I think, is that we're seeing a sort of polarisation in photography and documentary photography, where the stories either become much slower and more thoughtful and in-depth, hopefully done by people who really know what they're doing, who bring something to the party. Or in the case of press photography, you know, reportage, you have people with camera phones, and that's much more immediate. So these two extremes have become much more extreme. And the middle ground, of course, if you're a press photographer, I think you would have cause for concern or worry about your profession because it's being taken over by, you know, just random people with cameras. But that moment of being in that situation, I'm not sure even being a professional makes you take better pictures. In some ways, you tend to resort to sort of more cliched images, or you're looking for images you've seen 1,000 times before. Maybe you're even constructing pictures of heroism. You know, if you think of an earthquake, every press photographer is looking for the image of a firefighter cradling a baby coming out of the rubble. And we as the public, you know, lap it up as well. We kind of need it and we crave images of heroism. Mm. And what we're seeing from these terror attack images at the moment, there's no heroism there. We're not seeing these kind of comfortable Western cliches of firefighters and servicemen behaving nobly, because they were probably just as scared and shocked as everyone else. Mm. And in fact, even worse, what I'm seeing is the pictures of the soldiers marching around sort of aimlessly, not knowing what to do with themselves after the fact. They're all wearing face masks, which is extraordinary, to hide their identity. And I hadn't noticed that until I was looking at the images on the way here today. All of the soldiers in camouflage, all of the Belgian army that are on the streets around the airports, have got ski masks on or things pulled up over their face. And that's the sort of weird language of terrorism as well in itself.
I think that's really interesting. And that happened quite a lot this week, that some of the images, even some, you know, grainy CCTV screen grabs, which, you know, there's a picture which we're now looking at here in the studio, which I'm sure our listeners will be familiar with, which is of the two airport bombers alongside the so-called third man in the hat who was depicted alongside them. And that image was widely circulated, and it took a while before people started to look at it in a slightly more forensic way and say, right, well, hang on, why are these two guys wearing black gloves just on their left hands? And then it was again speculated that this was to conceal detonators, this kind of thing. And it's interesting because a CCTV screen grab, I guess, flies in the face of most of what your rigorous journalistic eye would say is good. There's no real clarity. It's not a crisp image. It's clipped off at a weird angle. Mm. You only see part of what's happening. And yet that maybe is as close as anything to a definitive image maybe from the week. Is that just because that's what happens?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's doubly chilling for its inadequacies as an image in a weird way. I mean, what's notable to me is how unthreatening these three men look at this moment. One of them looks like Inspector Clouseau in a ridiculous hat, probably some kind of disguise. One of them looks like Ringo Starr in an early Beatles movie in his sort of out of focusness, and the other one just looks like a sort of normal bloke. And that's chilling, because, you know, that makes us think next time we're at an airport and we're scanning around, we're surrounded by people who are similar.
Who just look like nobodies, yeah.
So it doesn't conform to this idea of, you know, a man in a uniform with an AK-47, you know, running rampage. And so it's doubly shocking. And I suppose, unfortunately, this kind of imagery and the fact that it's so banal and yet scary feeds into the idea of terror. You know, it means that we don't have a rule book anymore. The boundaries are all shifted. And so, in a weird way, it kind of helps the cause of terrorism.
Zed Nelson speaking to Tom Edwards. Now for a change of pace. Do you fancy a bit of a run? It is, of course, that time of the new year where many of us start thinking about how to reignite that spark in our fitness regime. As spring was dawning earlier this year, Tyler Brulé was joined by two gentlemen who share the fitness trade. Andy Waterman is the editor of Meter magazine, published by premium apparel brand Tracksmith, while Simon Freeman is the man behind Like the Wind magazine, an inspiring collection of personal anecdotes, beautiful illustrations, and stunning photography.
The idea for the magazine came to my wife and I when we were running around the Mont Blanc for our honeymoon, and we were actually talking about some of the titles that we've got here on the table, cycling magazines primarily, that I was obsessively buying despite not being a cyclist. But I loved them for their editorial content and for the design. And we just wondered whether there would be an appetite for that sort of magazine in the UK, in running, sorry. So
just on that point, I mean, were you thinking UK or were you thinking internationally right away when you conceived the idea for the magazine?
No, we were definitely thinking internationally.
Right.
Because actually our idea was that we would be publishing something quite high value or high cost at least. So we thought that we're only going to be reaching a relatively small part of the running population.
Right.
So we would need to sort of distribute globally. So we came home and spent our dwindling savings printing the first issue of the magazine and kept our fingers crossed that people would want to buy it.
And how many issues in now?
We've just published number 8 and we're working on number 9 of a quarterly title. So,
and Andy, Meter Magazine, of course, a title a little bit newer, out of the blocks.
Yeah.
I mean, format-wise, you know, a few similarities. But again, I guess from your side, you know, what was the realization in terms of scope in the marketplace?
So Meter Magazine is published by Tracksmith, which is a premium athletic clothing manufacturer. And we're a running clothing company. And we were kind of looking at running as a sport and thinking it had just been grossly misrepresented by the brands who kind of look after it.
Mm-hmm.
The magazines were kind of all part of that, and really no one was representing our experience of running. I'm obviously from the UK, the company is from the US, based in Boston. We had a kind of a lot of shared experiences, which we just really, really felt that running deserved better. And there were so many stories out there that were going untold, and they just really deserved to be put out there in a beautiful format.
Just to both of you, do you think that on one side there's this, you know, incredible sort of, you know, sense of reportage and delivering sort of, you know, great stories, and anyway, it's very much a departure from anyone who's familiar with Runner's World, and so many of the other titles which of course are out there, which are very product focused and very much focused on diet, etc. I'm wondering if there's a middle ground though, because I feel that, you know, so much of the newsstand is about this sort of, you know, this great storytelling that everyone wants to do today. But at the same time, is there room for product and to do product well, you know, and over a series of pages at the same time? Because there seems to be a bit of a gulf and divide, not just only running. I think even we look at a lot of cycling magazines, you know, I think, you know, as you were saying, Simon, there was that desire, there was that sort of, you know, looking at what happened at that part of the newsstand, which of course has now prompted things to happen in many other corners as well, whether it's tennis, you see all kinds of different magazines wanting to be in that territory. Wonder what your thoughts are.
Yeah, no, 100%. And actually, one of the things that we really would love to do is start working with brands in a really authentic way.
Mm.
I know we're going to get on to talking about magazines, but in the latest edition of Relais, there's a piece about a helmet manufacturer. And I kind of read it. I was really interested. I think the products are integral to the sport. I don't think they're in any way divorced. And Andy and I were talking about this earlier on, about the fact that these brands have huge history. I mean, very often they were facilitators of people doing great things. So I just think there's a bit of an education to be done with the brands that actually, if they're going to talk about what they're doing and their products, it needs to be in a way that is genuinely interesting rather than sort of a pure sales message.
Mm. I mean, Andy, you sit in a different, you know, I guess, in an interesting place, because obviously here's a magazine which is underwritten by a big brand, or not a big brand, but obviously a very boutique brand. So, of course, you have to play to that. So I'm wondering, is there a way of striking a balance, or has there been sort of an editorial decision, say, no, let's go and tell, you know, current issue, you know, whether it is a great piece about running in Japan, whether it's a profile of an individual, and let sort of, you know, product and everything else sort of really sit in the background.
Yeah, I think we're sharing more stories online now as well, and so we are actually doing some product focused pieces, but they tend to work better for us online. So we just published this morning a comment piece about choosing running shoes, and there's a lot of debate about running shoes. People love to argue about it. It's something that probably works better online than it does in the print magazine.
And why? Do you think because of just engagement, letting people have a go at each other? Or?
Yeah, because it will be shareable. It will be something that will start a conversation. The pieces in Meter are slower to read. They're something that you kind of sit back and you savour.
Mm.
And you don't necessarily get to the end and feel like, I need to share this. You've enjoyed it for what it is.
Mm.
I listened to a really good podcast yesterday, Ben Smith from BuzzFeed on the Longform podcast, and he was talking about exactly this and about the way online journalism can be shared.
Tyler Brulé with Andy Waterman and Simon Freeman. Gentle Rain is Hamburg's first English language magazine about the city, published by local media agency Die Brüder, which is also the founder of independent magazine conference IndieCon. Its debut issue hit newsstands this summer and is packed with tales from the German town, from the saga of Flotsam found in the shores of the Elbe to a portrait of native film producer Nicholas Schieback. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Urs Spindler, one of the four founders of the magazine.
We had the idea to make a magazine about Northern Europe for quite some time, because we think that there's a lot of interesting things that binds this northern region together, like design, like music. I think Hamburg is kind of the, maybe the south pole of this northern region that then heads up to Scandinavia, to maybe also the UK. Well, this project actually failed. We made a dummy. It was called Norden, which is the German word for north. We didn't get enough funding to do it, but we had it in our back pockets when we started talking with the city of Hamburg about doing a new magazine. They liked the idea. They also liked the idea to try to bundle together a whole region and to try to, well, find topics that are not only typical for Hamburg, but maybe for a bit of a broader area. And well, then we just refocused and rebuilt the concept, and it became Gentle Rain.
Let's start with the cover. I mean, I have a copy in front of me, but can you describe to us the first cover and where did the idea came from?
So the first cover shows a person in a Godzilla costume and a young woman with a very typical Hamburg dress, a raincoat, yellow raincoat. And there's a nice staircase, which is actually designed by the design office of Zaha Hadid. In the background, you see the tip of a building you will maybe come along a bit more often in the next few months or years. That is the new Elbphilharmonie of Hamburg. But you really see only the tip of it over the staircase. So that's the cover. And then there's, of course, a nice blue border and the logo of Gentle Rain.
But also moving on, I really like the topics. I mean, as I said, it's not an obvious guide for a city. I really like the interviews. For example, the interview with Evelyn Sibbert. She is the owner of a pub called Sea Devil in Hamburg. That's such an interesting interview as well.
Yeah, I think everybody loves Evie. She's just a great character. And my colleague Malte used to live in a flat right next to the pub. So he knew her intimately, sort of. We went there a lot of times, and he got in the circle, so it was possible to make this interview with her. All in all, I think the topics are, well, there's of course a lot of Hamburg in the magazine, but there's also a lot of stuff in there that I think many people can relate to that live in bigger cities or, cities of millions, basically, because we try to search for topics that are relevant, not only for people who are here, but also for people who are maybe living in London or maybe living in some other city. I don't know if you, for example, read the piece about the Sternschanze, which is a place in very central in Hamburg that used to be a quite rough neighborhood and that now has become, rather posh, I'd say. It still has some spaces that are, have more of an alternative air. But all in all, it's a very good example for how cities transform these days and how people who live there take part in that, but also maybe opposed to it. And, I think that's something that maybe you can relate to when you look at Shoreditch, for example, in London or at similar areas. I think it's maybe relevant even for you as well.
You know what? I actually was quite relevant because I really like the nature as well. I believe you went on this hike as well in the district of Newark, which is quite a remote suburb of Hamburg, you know. Very beautiful pictures as well. That's a side of Hamburg as well that I didn't expect, to be honest.
Yeah, that's, I'd say, the piece that survived of the original idea to go far north. It's actually, it's really a part of Hamburg, but it's an enclave, basically, on the shore, and it's directly at the seaside, very beautiful. It's part of the World Heritage One Sea, and if you are in Hamburg, well, it's not so far. You can also go there by boat, but you can also just take a train to Cuxhaven and then go from there. It's very easy. Yeah, it's very beautiful. So yeah, of course, it's also a side of Hamburg we love to show.
And also for those who are already thinking, when is the second issue coming out? How often do you want Gentle Rain on the newsstands? You know, I don't know, twice a month, or what's the frequency that you're thinking?
Well, if we had all the resources we wished for, we would maybe do it 4 times a year. Right now, we are planning on releasing the next issue in spring next year. So it would be 2 times a year. That's also something, of course, that you may feel in the magazine. Most of the stories are a little bit timeless. It doesn't really have much of a guidebook character. So it will not, I don't know, tell you about the events in the next few weeks or something. It's more about getting a general feel for the city of Hamburg and for, well, what's around here. So, yeah, well, right now, 6 months for each issue, we will take a lot of time to make it as good as possible.
Fernando Augusto Pacheco speaking to Urs Spindler. Over 300,000 visitors passed through the doors of the Frankfurt Book Fair earlier this year, with more than 7,000 exhibitors competing for their attention. At this year's event, Tyler Brulet caught up with Christoph Amend, editor-in-chief of one of our favourites, Zeit magazine. Christoph now has a new title in the newsstands, Zeit magazine Man, which is an impressive men's biannual title with a print run of about 60,000.
I think it's a great time to do a magazine for newspapers. And I think that's sort of a general observation you can make everywhere in sort of many European or American, European countries. I mean, look at M for Le Monde, or Volkskrant magazine in the Netherlands, or in Germany, Süddeutsche magazine, Zeit magazine, or New York Times, Sunday magazine, and T. I think we're sort of part of a general development of being able to use our editorial freedom to create something that is hopefully inspiring.
One of the interesting things, I used to work in the same environment as you, and I always hear people saying, oh, the days of the newspaper magazine are over, because they used to be great when photographers came back from wars and they had kind of sets of pictures, you ran them for the first time. Now, we can see those images on TV and on our web pages in a flash of a second. What's interesting is you've carved out a very different space, which is a little bit more whimsical, a little bit more kind of off-piece sometimes, but beautiful. What space do you think you occupy, and what are you trying? When you look at a good issue of your magazine, you think, okay, I'm happy about this. What are the boxes it's trying to tick?
Well, I mean, we still work with war photography and photographers who, you know, go to war territories and report from Syria, or we did a large story about the women who survived Boko Haram, the Boko Haram terrorism last year. But you're right in terms of we're not like able to send a photographer a year somewhere and have him come back and, you know, publish one story. But I think in terms of finding our editorial space that is not used anywhere else by any other magazines or websites, I mean, we're also able to sort of publish more personal stories by photographers, for example. We really believe that photographers and illustrators are authors, just like columnists and reporters. So what I do all the time, when I talk to photographers, I always ask them, what's the story that you're interested in right now? And that's how we sometimes come across like the most interesting stories. For example, last year at the Frankfurt Book Fair, I ran into a photographer from Munich, Olaf Unverzart, who sometimes has been working for us. And I just asked him, Olaf, what are you working on right now? And he took a pause and said, I'm thinking about doing a portrait of my grandmother, who is becoming 100 years old. And so I said, like, spontaneously, it sounds like a great story, do it for us. I never heard of him from him for like 6 or 7 months. And then I got an email with the first 15 photographs. And so we waited another 6 months, and then we published a cover story about his grandmother's life, who grew up in a small, remote Bavarian village and only left it twice in her whole life. So we published a story in January, and it just won the gold medal at Lead Awards in Hamburg just a couple of weeks ago. Actually, what happened, when I talked to Olaf the night he got this award from the Lead Academy, he said, you know what, when you asked me what are you working on, I wasn't working on anything. And I just thought I had to come up with something. And so he came up with the story of his grandmother.
I'm curious, how top-down is it? And we have experience in working in some magazine settings in the German market. at times I feel it's, at least in some titles, it's a bit more consensus driven and maybe not the sort of the singular voice of one editor. About what is it in your setup? Clearly your hand is there, but I'm wondering how much of a discussion is it? Because I'm also just fascinated to hear that you're having a conversation with a photographer, which, you know, to be honest, I don't think, Andrew, we're not really talking to photographers that much. We know what we want as a story, but I'm wondering, not to, of course, give away all of the special sauce at Zeit Magazine, but I'm just curious how it works for you.
You know, our creative director, Milka Bosch, he's based in Munich. Our art director, Jasmin Müller-Stohr, she's based in Berlin. We have our photo directors, Milena Carstens, and our photo consultant, Andreas Wellnitz. So there's a large group of people who are in touch with creatives, with illustrators and photographers and writers. And they all come in with new ideas, and so am I. And we discuss, of course, you know, for example, this story about Olaf's grandmother, when he sent in the first photographs, we discussed it openly. And that's a sort of a group of like maybe 5-6 people from the different departments who more or less have to agree to run the story.
You've moved into doing international versions of the magazine a couple of times a year. What was the thinking behind that? Was it mainly for your advertisers to kind of give them global credibility, or did you feel that there were people who needed to have a kind of insight into what people in Germany were thinking?
I think it was for a couple of reasons. One of the reasons was, of course, you know, sometimes you think, okay, we're producing a story about an international artist and it's written in German, and so we're reaching out to an audience in Switzerland, Austria and Germany, but that's it. And living in a global world that we all live in, and it was sometimes we had this kind of sad feeling of not being able to communicate our stories outside of the German-speaking territories. On the other hand, of course, for our publishing house to actually decide to run the international issue was probably one of the reasons that they could actually show the Italian and French and American and British clients, you know, it's actually true what we were saying for years and years and years. We're really doing quality journalism. Before that, you only had the chance to take a look at the photographs and the design of the magazine, but now you can actually read it.
Yeah. Tyler Brulé with Christophe Amend. And that's it for this week's show. My thanks to our producer, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and editor, Claire Urban. If you have any comments or queries, then drop Fernando a note over at fp@monocle.com. And do remember, we are back at the same time next Saturday. You can always catch up with the podcast at monocle.com or wherever you get your audio. And if you do fancy buying some of the titles we've mentioned on the stack, do pay us a visit over at the Kiosk Cafe. That's Monocle's very own newsstand in Paddington, here in London. You have been listening to The Stack. I'm Ben Ryland. Happy Christmas, and we'll catch you next week.